now, He-Man unleashes the meteors. Transforming creatures with prehistoric features. Heroic meteors, each sold separately.
Searching my past for the things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience.
I'm confident that my half-brother had Alpha Flight number 35, because that Shaman versus Talisman cover with reanimated skeletons is tight. Nobody seems to know for sure who drew it, though, and the collected edition stopped about 5 issues short of this one in 2016. To me, it's new series artist David Ross, looking a lot better here than on the Jerry Taliok inked interiors, reminding me that we don't talk enough about how he butchered early Mike Mignola work. Talking of whom, Mignola is often credited with participation in this cover. And yeah, skeletons, but I just don't see it. I'm pretty sure that's just Kevin Nolan inks with more fidelity to Ross's line work than he's usually associated with. He doesn't always completely redraw an image, you know. Though the interiors, it's a Mariner spotlight featuring Submariner and Atlantis. Who cares? Grimjack number 24 was a 1989 back issue for me, and the first time I got to read the initial chapter of the debut tale, Mortal Gods. Then Bob Violence from the post-shaken American flag used the Munden's Bar section as a promotional tool. I guess it was a big enough deal to reach the 2-year mark that co-creator Tim Truman came back for a new wraparound cover and 8-page anniversary story. All this breaks my usual rules for the project, but I don't like the first week of titles being only 2 comics deep before cutting to a bumper. I think the cover art for Sergio Aragonés grew the Wanderer number 16, in which the barbarian prepares to hack at a fly on his own nose with a short blade, was used as a house ad. Like its inspiration Conan, I read a lot of these comics, but they're all so similar that I can rarely recall one from another. Again, I mostly mention it to fill out the week. The Marvel Saga, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe number 7, continues to answer the question of how I was relatively familiar with the backstories of Tony Stark and James Rhodes, despite rarely even flipping through the Iron Man comics growing up. Knowing where their moneymaker was, the Brent Anderson cover highlights J. Jonah Jameson's crusade against Spider-Man. A lot of this issue was taken up by recaps of Human Torch and Ant-Man solo stories, necessitating the disclaimer that I never bought a single issue of this series. I only read my brother's copies. The official handbook of the Marvel Universe Deluxe Edition number 7 announced on the cover that you wouldn't be getting any headliners by fronting with villains. And it is Korifos to Magneto after all. But you did get some nice entries for minor characters. Joe Kubert on Killer Shrike, Sandy Plunkett's Hannibal King, Cary Gamble's Misty Knight, Bill Sienkiewicz's Legion, Mike Zeck's Living Laser, Paul Smith's Lockheed, Art Adams's Longshot, and especially Mark Beecham's Madam Mask. Walt Simonson also got a lot of play on Curse, Loki, and Lorelei, plus David Mazzucchelli's Kingpin. I'm also weirdly into the various Kree militia uniforms. Am I secretly Super Sentai sensitive or something? Getting off light on TV in March. What's to talk about? Well, Valerie, a domestic comedy featuring the former supporting player on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, who spun off into 5 solo seasons of Rhoda, Ms. Valerie Harper. It was Jason Bateman's first steady gig, mostly launching his career. I'll be honest, I always found him smug. And this is coming from someone who was following the career of Kirk Cameron. But I still watch Valerie on occasion, though more so when the show experiences a major shakeup after season 2. I think my grandmother watched the little murder she wrote, but it never appealed enough to me to share any time with her on that. I'm more confident that Mama all liked Andy Griffith, who joined the Barnaby Jones Elder Investigator set as defense attorney Matlock. Even after 9 seasons and nearly 200 hours of television, I believe they went back for a bunch of TV movies and more Kentucky Fried Justice. Last I checked, it was still a nursing home favorite, but I mostly missed it. I was more into the new sitcom Perfect Strangers, in which a curly-haired Nebish takes in his Eastern European cousin Balki, basically the prototype for Borat, but much gentler, played by that guy who had the great cameo in Beverly Hills Cop as the gay art dealer. I eventually lost interest on the front end of its 8 seasons and 150 episodes, and never followed it into syndication.
There are 2 new faces coming to Tuesday night.
So you 2 are going to be on Tuesday nights, huh?
Yeah, hope you guys can cut it.
Hey, remember, Tuesday nights are pretty hot around here.
Well, don't worry, we won't let you down.
Better not. Do you remember everything we taught him?
Well, sure he does. Of course he does, Balki.
Does an ant farm? Does a picket fence? Hey, oh, Angela, check me in. There she was, just walking down the street.
Perfect Strangers, the perfect comedy on the perfect night starting tomorrow.
Avengers number 268 struck me as familiar, despite having a generic cover with a growing man on it. Or rather, the big orange and purple guy that I thought was a Kree robot or something and had to look up. I knew it wasn't one of mine, but my brother was even less of an Avengers guy than I was. Cracking the cover, the splash page has a Buscema Palmer shot of Captain America crouching in a cave with a flashlight while Jarvis looks on. Yeah, okay. The story is titled The Kang Dynasty, and hey, how's that going? The image of a downed original golden armor Iron Man confirmed that I knew this one, but that leads to appearances by Kang and Space Phantom, who were not draws to us. Gah, what was it with this one? 8 pages in and finally, the Dire Wraiths showed up. My brother liked Dire Wraiths. Mystery solved. Conan the Barbarian number 183 offered Blood Dawn, a Jim Owsley, John Buscema, and Ernie Chan collaboration about vampire zombie priest things from out of Beastmaster. I didn't buy it on purpose, so it was likely a 3-pack or my brother's again. The story ended with a black man kissing a hateful white woman's foot. A little bro had transgressive tastes. Finally, Elvira's House of Mystery number 4. As I've mentioned before, I watch Movie Macabre most weekends, especially if Saturday Night Live was a rerun. I caught Elvira on stuff like beer commercials and Halloween episodes of shows like The Fall Guy, and would have her moonbathing poster on my wall in a few years. So of course I had to talk about her first comics run, which I fished out of quarter bins early and fairly often. That said, this is one of the few times I can discuss an issue I actually bought brand new off the stands. Or actually, I'm pretty sure I got this one at my first semi-proper comic shop. The one inside the South Houston flea market that had its own doors and walls and posters and display shelves and a cash register and everything. The first issue was a double-length, double-priced horror anthology in which Elvira only cameoed, so it's possible I rejected it at a mall bookstore. But I got really excited when I saw Mark Beecham and Dick Giordano's Peekaboo cover. Besides both artists being masters of drawing sexy ladies, they also dodged likeness issues that even Ryan Boland stumbled over by having Elvira cover a third of her highly recognizable face with her hands. The layout of the cover is strikingly similar to John Byrne's green foil enhanced one for the Sensational She-Hulk number 50, down to her eyes and nose being covered up by the logo. So out of all the books I could have gotten on this relatively rare opportunity at specialty access, I got one that was technically available in the newsstand, though I rarely ever saw it there. But again, I wasn't a short story collection guy until this century, and Elvira was literally only on the splash page. I might have been put off forever, except it was a really great issue. The lead story was by Heather Kilgore, with inks by Jim Fern and script by Rory Metcalf and Gael Montgomery. Most of these people only have a single credit in the comics industry, but Kilgore went on to become a noted illustrator, who worked in the art department for revered fantasy films like Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The art is lovely, and the gothic romance story certainly stands out in this volume. A little Trevor Von Eden, some much Steve Lee Aloha. The art is worth the price of admission on its own. Next comes a Kane pinup by Sean McManus in full Bernie Wrightson mode. Surely one of his most fantastic pieces. The second and final story is by Dennis Yee, whose credits are also sparse and mostly restricted to the 1986-87 window on a little-known indie book for Elite Comics called Sea Dragon. Like Elvira, I saw one or two of those in the Marauder Books quarter bin, and Yee could have used the Jim Fern inks there that he enjoyed here. The story, She Knows, Someone Is Watching Her, is extremely prescient, about an independent African-American woman whose life is gradually made smaller and more fearful by an overweight white incel who stalks her. Aside from the Bronze Age art style, you'd think this tale was produced today, and it made an impression on me. G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero number 48, had a Mike Zeck Zartan cover, so I showed up for it. The whole issue is about mistaken identity. Snake Eyes in his latex face mask looking like a regular G.I., the guy people think is Zartan isn't, the guy people think are Joes are actually Zartan, and nobody knows who new recruit Sergeant Slaughter is, but they mess around and find out. I know who he is. Besides being a famed WWF wrestler, he was one of the few celebrities to follow me on Twitter. Marvel Tales number 188 reprinted 1967's Amazing Spider-Man number 48, in which a younger guy with a full head of dark hair took over the role of the Vulture. It's from the classic team of Stan Lee and John Romita, but don't ask me why I felt the need to buy this specific issue. Repack strikes again? I strongly associate Uncanny X-Men number 206 with the apartment my father's family was living in when I first started visiting them on odd weekends. My father had this huge, ornate, uncomfortable antique couch that I maybe rented on. Also, he was still a bohemian age of Aquarius type, and my half-sister still has major woo-woo hippie-dippy vibes to this day. The baby mama I liked when I saw her, but she mostly dipped out to the bedroom with her wine and Anne McCaffrey books. I think my half-brother was living with his mother at the time, so he may have been a fellow weekend traveler. Anyway, based on comics chronology, my father's family came by and wrecked my place around Christmas, and I was reading my half-brother's John Romita Jr. drawn Freedom Force Battle that spring. Beginning in late 1985 with the release of their ninth studio album, Miami Sound Machine finally broke through with the hit single Conga. The Gloria Estefan fronted band had two other major hits off the album, Bad Boy and Words Get in the Way. Maybe it's a Latin environment thing, but it was still rare for me in my country oldies bubble to get exposed to every major single from a new pop album. Obviously, they'd stick around for a while too. I Can't Wait by New Shoes is the kind of song I used to save for a different podcast, one song each, but we haven't been able to pull one of those together in a few years. Also, I'm not sure I could stretch the topic out long enough. I think I first heard the song in 1987, and its low-key, lusty girl vibe just did it for me. I love the Ferris Bueller-style goofy computer program synth noises, Valerie Day's slightly nasal vocals, and even the empty toolbox of a music video. I bought one of their CDs and listened to their other singles, and I wish I liked any of it half as much as this one tune. Okay, Point of No Return is also pretty good, and it has the proto-Michelle Gondry stop-motion video, but that's about it. Plus, when I hear that song, I always think of Exposé first, not New Shoes. By the way, the husband and wife act are still together in their 60s and have aged extremely well. I first heard Harlem Shuffle by the Rolling Stones at a school dance. I assumed it was an old song like Steam's Na Na Hey Hey Kiss Him Goodbye, also at that same dance. But apparently it was more a matter of months than years for the former. Another thing that I thought came later, the first Van Hagar single, Why Can't This Be Love? Can you believe Van Halen went straight from Hot for Teacher to that pap? I can't. But partly because the version of the band fronted by Sammy Hagar did not get the same level of exposure as David Lee Roth's. Point of fact, I'm not even sure I knew the band had a separate existence from the singer, since I was still hearing his solo work and digging it. I don't remember hearing any Van Hagar until their second album in 88. I featured a snippet of How Will I Know last episode, because that was the first Whitney Houston I remember hearing. She just missed the top 40 in 1984, but You Give Good Love and Saving All My Love for You came in third and first respectively in 1985. All that was left for 1986 was the seventh and final single off of her eponymous debut, The Greatest Love of All. We all know it. It's timeless. I'm just acknowledging the point at which I joined the zeitgeist. At the mall bookstore, I flipped through the collector's edition premier issue of Green Lantern Corps number 201. Yeah, that wasn't fooling anybody. And despite trying to rebrand as a team book, this was just a bunch of goofy-looking corpsmen with the same powers and costume. And one's a chipmunk now. No, sir, you can keep that. It's going to be another decade and a half before I'm making time for chipmunk protagonists in my comics again. I'm a serious comic book collector, don't you know? The all-new, all-different Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man number 115, is another comic read on a delay. I don't know if it was a three-pack, one of my bros' books, whatever. I just know that I'd stopped actively collecting this book, but read this issue within a year or two of release. I shouldn't have waited, since it's a Peter David story and Mark Beecham art, only slightly toned down by Bob McLeod inks. Maybe not the best call, given the unusually unambiguous attempted RAPE that starts the issue. That must give you enough without later cutting to Felicia Hardy prancing around in material thin enough to be full-body pantyhose. But Tutti Frutti, Spidey gives good booty, so there's equal time and place. We've got Doctor Strange, we've got a dude with a 2-foot mohawk nearly a decade after the days of punk. It's all good. Maybe one of the best criticisms of the Leighton Geist run on X-Factor that I can offer comes specifically from number 5, which introduces a new supergroup, the Alliance of Evil, made out of threats from previous issues. What do I remember most? Not the team, but the sequence where a largely hairless Hank McCoy goes shopping for a new business suit. I'm the target audience for this hot new book. Looking at a beast overdosed on depilaries, dressed like Herb Tarlac with a worse haircut, wonder why Marvel thought this was what I wanted to read. Just pages of boring post-grad X-Men I was already suffering through in Marvel Saga, and my brother's cut-rate, low-grade back issues, and they're hanging out in a regular gym, not a danger room, they're talking on the phone, attending business meetings, hanging out with Rusty, Skids, and Artie. The lousy supervillains that didn't make an impression in the first four issues don't even show up until page 17. As I understand it, the last page reveal that the arc's mastermind was the Daredevil villain Owl was so underwhelming that editor Bob Harris had the incoming replacement writer create a brand new foe, and the artist redrew them in silhouette to tease their full debut. Didn't mean much to me then, though. That'll change for the greater X title buying public.
For 500 years, they have waited for this day. Two immortals able to survive anything but each other. Highlander. Here we belong. starring Christopher Lambert and Sean Connery. Featuring original songs by Queen. Highlander, There Can Be Only One, rated R.
Starts Friday at a theater near you. Check newspapers for listings.
Obviously, I was not on the ground in Japan in 1986 when the Fist of the North Star anime debuted. It just seems an opportune time to note that as an old school nerd, I was proximal to first wave American otaku who imported and translated titles like this in the late 80s and early 90s. This was the Land of the Rising Sun's take on the Land Down Under's post-apocalyptic road warriors, including an impossibly over-muscled Mad Max lift prone to pressure point punches that elicited geysers of blood. It was so ridiculous and nothing in live action could touch it, so we loved it. I didn't get to see all that much of it, and I sure didn't understand what I did beyond a surface level, but it's a straight line from this to the Mortal Kombat video game franchise. Like most of the world, I missed Highlander theatrically, but it was part of my hot streak of early VHS rentals when we finally got a VCR. In fact, it may well have been my first ever rental, since the other two I immediately recall were Big Trouble in Little China and Howard the Duck, which were summer theatrical releases. Was there anything more 80s than a grizzled white man in a trench coat wielding a katana sword on a rain-swept New York rooftop? Immortals engage in a centuries-long contest for godlike power acquired through parking lot decapitations with an all-new Queen soundtrack at their most bombastic. And bonus Sean Connery somehow entering his heyday at 56 years of age, introducing me to favorite character actors like Christopher Lambert and Clancy Brown. And it's all self-contained, with the satisfying ultimate conclusion that there can only be one. This is so perfect. Nothing could ever ruin this, right? Instead of Highlander, we were catching Police Academy 3 back in training at the Dollar Show. It was absolutely declining returns, but the profits were still multiplied nearly tenfold over the budget. At least we still had Steve Guttenberg playing Sergeant Kerry Mahoney as a proper lead within the ensemble. Plus, this was the last one with Art Matrano as Commandant Mauser. For some reason, they brought back Captain Harris for the fourth one, and Matrano suffered a spinal injury in 1989 that he never fully recovered from. And I'm not trying to pit the actors against one another, I like both characters, but this was the last one that wasn't completely worthless. Police Academy needed all the help it could get. Oh, and we saw the money pit. I don't recall if it was a Dollar Show or on VHS. It was not my favorite Tom Hanks movie. More damning, not my favorite Shelley Long movie either. Not that it was terrible, I'd remember terrible. This was 90 minutes of our house is broken jokes.
Well, I'm a honky-tonk man, ain't a crazy style. Love to give the girls a whirl to the music of an old jukebox. When my money's all gone, I'm on the telephone singing, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home?
I've repeatedly brought up issues of Miller and Mazzucchelli's Born Again arc that I did not buy at the time, but Daredevil number 232's nationalistic God and Country really stands out. I know that I gave this a toss at the neighborhood 7-Eleven, but just like that one Alan Moore Swamp Thing I got, I just knew this was too mature for me at that time. Too complex, over my head, save it for later. But Nuke's paramilitary rampage and that iconic final splash of Daredevil back in costume were making me itchy. Little Bro bought Star Comics' Masters of the Universe number 2. The DC miniseries was too grown up, Alfredo Alcala, gritty Conan looking for my taste in 1982. And the past prime Ron Wilson drawing Transformers that turn into rocks, excuse me, meteorites, was too corny kitty. Bro had some of those rock figures, as in dumbass, or added an additional S, but I'm trying to keep it clean here. Don't miss the first issue in Webb's Daring New Adventures into Mystery and Suspense, announced a large yellow-tipped cover explosion with heavy emphasis on the first issue. This was Webb of Spider-Man number 16. You guys literally had an actual first issue barely over a year earlier. And yeah, we noticed that the only point was to add a third Spidey monthly title with Charles Best covers. This title was always the least among unequals, the directionless title with the worst creative teams. But hey, at least it's a new team, unlike the Green Lantern scam. Technically, David Michelinie had been writing since number 8, halfway to this point, but he only did a two-parter and split, except he came back with number 14, so this was his third consecutive issue. It isn't even the start of a lame multi-title story arc, which comes next issue. Nope, it's just Mark Silvestri's first issue in a whopping 7-month run, and he skips number 21. Also, Michelinie leaves with number 24. I don't know if Little Bro got suckered, or he just liked the horror-themed cover with a pitchfork skewering Spidey's mask while another maniac with a hand scythe stalks a cubbull in a nighttime field. The interiors are just Spidey versus Mega Rednecks. Sorry, Rednecks and supervillain called Magma. You can't see me shrug. And again, technically this issue continues in the next, which does officially start the Missing in Action arc. But I already mentioned the shrug. Let's wrap a lackluster month with West Coast Avengers number 10. The cash grab second Avengers title that at least had a few more reasons to exist than Web of Spidey. You don't necessarily see it with this unnecessary issue, though. Another little bro buy, I guess for the villainous Griffin, but maybe also Headlock? Chalk it up to youthful indiscretion. March of 1986 seems to have been uneventful, or at least nothing that punctured my baby boy bubble as of yet. Bit of a calm before the storm of next month. I can talk a little bit about the Oscars, I guess. I started paying attention to Oscar winners in 1981, the year Chariots of Fire won. Vangelis' theme song was inescapable for years afterwards, whether in sincere tribute, on mood music albums advertised on TV, or in comedic parodies. I might have been miffed if I'd known the movie had beaten out Raiders of the Lost Ark, but in my family circles, it was on Golden Pond that seemed to resonate the most as a proper adult drama. In 1982, when Gandhi won, I'd have probably rooted for E.T., but it was Tootsie that got the most chatter. This was especially true locally, because it was thought that Dustin Hoffman's portrayal had strongly mirrored Houston Mayor Kathy Whitmire. 1983 was Terms of Endearment, I think generally considered the right call, though I'm sure its Space City ties didn't hurt that perception. The big chill and the iconic slow walk and the right stuff still rate mention. I confess I've never seen any of them, though. 1984 was Amadeus, the first year I recall the Oscars being called out as being a bunch of out-of-touch elites. I recall The Killing Fields and Place in the Heart being discussed more. 1985 was Out of Africa, and I think this was when I first became aware of what a highly regarded actress Meryl Streep was becoming. I'd seen and liked her in Kramer vs. Kramer and especially Silkwood, but Sophie's Choice and The French Lieutenant's Woman were getting hyped television play by that point. Robert Redford was already an institution, and in fact that seemed to play into the Academy handing it the gold, despite my hearing it was an undeserving snore. Obviously The Color Purple was the best picture of that year, and of most years, but even in 1986 I heard more about every other nominee but Africa, including Witness, Prince's Honor, and Kiss of the Spider-Woman, which I was disappointed to learn had nothing to do with Jessica Drew. Anyway, sorry for the second movie segment. That won't be an issue in April, when things are going to go nuclear. Folks who'd like to see our resume include Billy Hines on In My Way to Bluer Skies, who added, "It's the sport of kings, Proustian kick to the head." Brad Lennard, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners. Chris Dunford, who added, "Yes, yes, yes." Chris Leiden, Conventure Comics. Dave's Comic Heroes Blog. Derek W.C., Dulce Ray, Ed Moore, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Was, Interesting, Irredeemable Shag, JMT Productions, Julia Raul, Kailash Jwalamukhi, writer and media in charge, Kaori Mia, Keith G. Baker, Kaino Konoyama, MM Beats, Maxo, Miguel Galindo, Mooney Machan, NFTI Fan, Randy Caldwell, Satin Tights, a Wonder Woman podcast, Serpy Matt, and Superbound. Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy, what memory?